Hey, what's up, guys? This is Deion Brown, and you are listening to Man vs. Brand. I want to start this episode off with a quote. Now, this was a quote that was given by the old and great President Theodore Roosevelt. And this is something that he said in particular to critics in his speech, Citizenship in a Republic, in 1910. So here's what he said. It is not the critic who counts. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by the dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory or defeat. Now, why this quote seems relevant in this particular conversation is because we're going to have a conversation about being your best person. And being your best person in a way means that you fight the critic in your head. Now, listen, there's going to be tons of people out in the world that will have their own opinion about your success, about your product, about your service, about your life. And to some extent, those people matter. The people that you're in social contract with matter. Your wives, your husbands, your children, your partners, right? Those people's opinion matter. Then we have the next level, right? The people that are in your network. Then you have the next level, right? The people that are on the internet that can have an opinion, and the internet provides them a place for that opinion to have some level of validity, some level of life. But the critic that you will most have to challenge and triumph against is the critic that exists in your own self. The person that goes, hey, you're not smart enough, accomplished enough, well-read enough. You're not strong enough. That's the person that you will ultimately have to bring to heel and create an advocate for, right? You're going to have to get yourself to go, you're amazing. You are talented. You are worthy. And when you enter that space of changing a negative self-critique into empowerment, that's when we really start to become our best, most excellent self. So to have this conversation about what it takes to be your most excellent self, I have Rael Bricker with me. He's going to talk to you guys about his own process, how he started in the mines and moved his way into the boardroom, ultimately becoming a coach, an advocate for entrepreneurs across the globe. How did he do that? How did he figure out how to create a space for himself where he could not only empower others, but he could utilize his successes and failures? That's an important part, man. His successes and failures to create programming and coaching that could help others to succeed. If you're interested in that conversation and you want to hear more, except I don't have any more Theodore Roosevelt quotes to give you guys. If you want to hear what we have to talk about on this episode of Man vs. Brand, then you are in the right place at the right time. So we're going to start this episode in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
One of the greatest philosophers of our time once said that when it's up, then it's stuck. Find out how to make your next big idea stick with Deion Brown and his podcast. With 20 years of experience in growing and managing businesses and brands at the highest level, Deion is having the conversations that you are looking for. Welcome and have a great time.
Rael, what's going on, buddy? How are you doing, man?
Hey, fantastic, Deion, from the opposite end of the world. I'm in the future. I can tell you what's going to happen tomorrow.
You absolutely can. Listen, I love talking to folks in other time zones. You're in Australia. Which city are you in?
I'm in Perth on the West Coast.
Beautiful.
Cool place to live. 2.5 million people. Really chilled lifestyle. 70 kilometers of beachfront. Really, really cool place to be.
That sounds lovely, man. So what in your life right now informs your decision? Like, is it your family? Is it your drive? Like where, how do you, what drives you to get up every morning and go, I need to become a better person than I am today?
So can I want to clarify that a little bit. So sure. I talk about excellence, okay? And how did excellence come about as a theme for everything I do? I worked out that we can never be perfect, and that's probably a problem in the Instagram age today and the TikTok age, that there's this whole concept of we have to be perfect, okay? And so I said, we can never be perfect. We can just be the best version of ourselves every day. And so we're not trying to be the best version. I'm not trying to be Dion Brown. You know, I'm trying to be Rail Bricker. And I want to show up as, and I use the example, and Aussies love their beer. Aussies love to drink, okay? And I use the example often in the corporate sense. I say, even if you are hungover to hell today, I want you to show up as the best version of your hungover self. It's probably not as good as the person you were yesterday, but it's the best version of yourself today.
Got it.
Okay. And that's kind of important. So it's, yes, we'd love to be on this journey to excellence where every day is better, but some days we always step back. It's just the nature of the world. It's the nature of ourselves that we can't keep going on this journey. Some days we have a bad day. But as long as your bad day, you're the best version of yourself on that bad day, then you're doing the best you can. Then you're excellent. And if you're excellent, I mean, when we were at school and we were told we were excellent, that was the best compliment we could get. And we somehow forget that when we leave the schoolyard.
Absolutely, man. We used to get gold stars. Gold stars would be our indicator of how great we were, right? 5 stars would be excellent. 4 would be great. 3 would be, you know, medium, average, right? You got to 2 and 1, then, you know, you really had a star, but I think it was really to help every kid feel special. But we definitely knew that the 1s and 2 stars weren't it. But listen, I want to talk to you, right? Like, so what about you, right? What informs your own drive to self-evolve, right? To become a better version of yourself than you were yesterday, or at very least, the best version of yourself that you can be in the moment that you're in.
So what drives me? I mean, I guess I've always had this absolute belief in self. And at times, obviously, we get this thing called imposter syndrome, and there's lots of people writing about it. And but I'll use an example going back, you know, to my first business in 1990. I was a 26-year-old MBA graduate. My business partner was a 26-year-old MBA graduate. And we started a business, and we thought we were going to tell the world how to run their businesses. Of course, we'd never run a business ourselves, but that lack of knowledge didn't stop us, because we absolutely believed in self. And how do you create that belief in yourself? There's a lot of ways I do that with people now. So one of the things is you stop comparing yourself, and that's part of the problem of the internet generation. You know, you stop comparing yourself to the woman, and you know, the girls, particularly the women in the bikini on Instagram, and oh my God, my body's not good enough. I can't put myself out there. But compare yourself to yourself. I mean, as at this morning, I'm 25 pounds lighter than I was this time last year. Okay. And my doctor said to me yesterday, he said, how did you manage that? And I said, you know what? I just actually said to myself, this is not on. I need to, it wasn't from lack of exercise or anything. I was just eating too much and having too much of a good life. And I just toned down on what I ate. I changed the level of exercise I did, but I still go out and I enjoy my whiskeys and I enjoy my wine and I enjoy my good food, but a different level of moderation. And I've lost 11 kilos or 22 pounds.
What you're describing sounds like to me is discipline, right? It's that is what that sounds like to me, right? It's a level of discipline where you are self-monitoring the results of your action and then determining whether that result is what you want, and then adjusting your behavior in accordance to the result that you ultimately want to see.
I think yes, but the biggest thing there is my measurement tool is myself.
Sure.
And not external measures.
Absolutely. Agreed. I think we're saying the same thing. Yeah.
So that's the critical element, is that I'm measuring myself against myself and no one else. So, you know, I play competitive hockey. That's not the game with a flat thing on a piece of ice. That's a round ball on grass.
Like field hockey. Field hockey for the Americans listening. We're talking about field hockey.
Yeah, right. Yes. And at age 58, I still play competitive field hockey. And we have our finals actually this weekend. We came second on the league table. Now we're playing finals this weekend. And in our team, when I go out and say, and I've done that to myself over the years that I've played, oh, I want to play just like that guy because he's better than me. I've had a bad game. But if I've gone out there and said, I'm just going to do what I think I can achieve, and then I've had the most amazing game because I've just been the best version of myself that day. I haven't compared myself to anyone else.
Well, okay. So I hear that. And I believe in that to an extent, right? I believe that 150% that self-actualization, self-realization is important, using your own life and your own want to accomplish as a litmus test for whether you're doing well or not. All sounds good. But then there's a part of me that also says that that having something be aspirational or having something serve as a role model for the next level is also important, right? Because we also then see what maybe the next level is, and that next level then helps us to break down the ceilings that we create for ourselves. So how does ceiling breaking and looking at role models and then being able to use what they're doing as maybe your next step play into your philosophy?
Okay, so I actually go the other way. I go, when one of the things I work with people on and companies, and I do this a lot, is what I call the 5 W's, the 5 W goal setting. So a lot of gurus out there over the years, and I've been to lots of their talks, tell you, take a set of, you know, 3M sticky notes and write your goals on them and stick them on your mirror. And yep. Every morning you get up and, you know, you maybe shave or you at least do your makeup or look in the mirror and you go, oh, okay, that's my goal. Like, this is my goal. And you visual, you know, but the problem with that, and you mentioned the word self-actualizing, Maslow's hierarchy, the top of the hierarchy says self-actualization. The problem is if you just have a goal that stands in isolation, and you get to achieve that goal, you self-actualize on that goal, the question is, now what? Like, where do you go from there?
Yep.
So I use this thing. So there's, I'll start a bit with psychology. There's this thing in the back of the brain called the reticular activating system. And that's just a mechanism for telling you you're doing the right thing. So you go and buy the red Porsche, right? And you, because you've never seen a color red like that before and you love the color, I guarantee you that if you buy it and you drive out of the dealership within the way home, 10 miles, you will see 3 other red Porsches because your brain is now suddenly aware of that thing.
Yes.
And so the thing behind this as well is that this part of your brain says, if you can visually or vividly imagine something, the brain can't tell the difference between something that's vividly imagined and the truth and reality. So if you can then visualize your goal, and so that's what the 5 W's are. The first one of those is, when are you setting it? So you have to time bound it. So, you know, we're sitting here and so we would say, okay. And the classic was someone who was on one of my coaching programs. I said, what's your time bound? She said, 15th of December. I said, why the 15th of December? She said, because we're having, so that was the second of the W's. She said, Where are we? She said, we're at the staff Christmas party. I said, fantastic. And I said, so the third W is, who are you with? And she said, I'm with my entire team. And she said, what are you doing? That's the fourth W. And she said, we're drinking champagne and lots of beer. And I said, great. So you've gone through, and in your brain, you have wired your brain to see the Christmas party with your staff, drinking champagne, and who's there?
Wait, pause. Give me one second, Rael. I want to just go over this, because so this is a person, and you're asking them to envision a future, right?
Well, I know. So I'm getting to the fifth W.
Well, no. I just want to back this up for the audience.
I want them to visualize.
Yep.
The celebration of achieving their goal.
Ah, okay. That's the part that I don't think I didn't know. So she's in your space talking to you, and she is envisioning this future in which they have achieved a goal, and this is the result of them achieving the goal.
Correct.
Perfect.
And the fifth W is the why, which is, and her why was, this was during the pandemic, by the way.
Okay.
And she said her goal was to make sure they got through to December without having to get rid of any staff in their business.
Okay.
So her goal was to retain all her staff. That was her goal, as stuck up on the mirror. But in order to make that goal real, I got her to put a visualization around it. And the visualization was the staff Christmas party. And she could see the staff Christmas party with all the same staff sitting around. And that made the goal real for her and achievable.
So okay. Let's say that, I don't want to get into the politics of comparative thought, right? But
yeah.
Let's say that with her business model and cohorts that were in similar business models, were able to expand their business, does it then stand to reason that while her vision is to retain staff, that there is an alternate vision where if she is looking at the competitive landscape or the market in whole, that she could then envision a space where she is in a growth space, like maybe some of the people that are in her industry, as opposed to a retention space?
So this goal was set in May 2020.
Got it.
So we just started the pandemic. Like literally, we didn't actually even understand what COVID really was at that stage. Okay. And so put that into a context, their business is now double the size 2 years later.
Got it.
Okay. But her first focus at the beginning of COVID, when nobody wanted to be around anybody. So their business is a mechanical workshop, but it's an independent workshop designed to look like a dealership's workshop. So very slick, very clean looking, not like the traditional old mechanics workshop where there's 17 layers of oil on the floor. Okay. You know, it was designed to look like if you walked into the Toyota dealer or the Chevrolet dealer, that's what you would see in the back of their workshop. That's how they designed this workshop.
Apple store of workshops.
An Apple store of workshops.
Yeah.
The shiny floor, the matched hoists all the way down the room, etc.
Yep.
So they had finished building that in December 19, and this was 6 months later. So they had spent a lot of money putting this together, came to May 2020, when suddenly there were government lockdowns, people weren't driving as much, their cars were staying in the garage, there wasn't as much need for servicing. And there was a question of, could she keep all her staff on salary because of not having enough work for them?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the driver behind that goal. 6 months later, once WA, so we were in a bit of a unique position here in Perth that we effectively had no COVID for 18 months.
Okay.
Their borders were shut down. They wiped out COVID. And then basically we had 6 weeks of lockdown and then life was basically normal here for a long period. And so then suddenly people started driving again and, you know, everything else happened and suddenly their business took off like crazy. But when I went to see her in about October of that same year, she said the goal was still the same because she'd already achieved it. She'd actually got on more staff. She'd retained all the existing staff. And now she was setting goals. They were putting in new equipment and new services, et cetera. And I was working with them on putting in the new services. But at the time, that goal was very self-serving.
Okay.
It was, this is going to be my focus to make sure we get through.
All right. So I want to talk to you about something that I read in your bio. It talks about you being 6,000 feet underground in a mine. So yes. Talk to me, what that guy, right, who was in the mines, what was he imagining his life to look like? And how do you see that imagining manifesting in your life today?
Okay, so it's interesting. I was a 21-year-old. My parents weren't in a position to pay for my university studies.
Yep.
And so I got a scholarship, a loan effectively from a large mining company called Anglo American. And basically they expected me to work for them for a minimum of 2 years after graduation, which was fine. And I ended up working for them for 2 years after graduation. So I was this 21-year-old university graduate going into an environment where university graduates were in the minority for a start.
Okay.
I worked on a mine, 50,000 employees, 51,000 employees. And there were probably less than 1,000 graduates out of that group. So that just put into a context. We'd come out of university. I was president of the radio station. I was a high flyer at university. And so I had a bit of an ego problem at the time as well, which is a completely separate conversation we can have.
Okay.
I got to the mines and I drove my bosses mad because even though I was what was called a junior engineer at the time, I was more interested in seeing how did my role impact on the roles of others around me. So I always understood this interconnection between people. And I met so many people who'd been there in the same job for 10, 15, 20 years. And I'd say to them, so you go to work, you do your job, you go home. How does what you do at work impact on, you know, I could take it to the greatest level, which is the profitability of this major corporation getting the gold out the ground. So you know, we had to get the gold out, process it, and sell it. That was, you know, the in a nutshell, the processing. And for me, I questioned from day one what my role was and how I could be better at my role to impact those around me and then impact the great organization. And I probably only realized what I was doing 10 years later. When I started analyzing my behavior, it wasn't a conscious behavior. It was a very unconscious behavior at the time. But it was an interesting time in my life. I learned so much about leadership while I worked on the mines. I mean, put that into context. 1986, 87 in South Africa was a number of years before Nelson Mandela was released. There was still an apartheid government. Being a young white kid, I was privileged by law, not by anything else. Okay. It was what it was in the apartheid South Africa at the time. And I'm not justifying apartheid or anything else in our conversation. I'm just saying that was the position I found myself in, where as a young white employee on the mine, there were certain jobs reserved only for whites. Okay. Because there were, you know, in my engineering class, to give you an example, there were about 120 people who graduated. There were 3 people of color in my entire engineering group that graduated. All right.
Wait, I love this story, but I also want to make sure that we're getting to the vision that you had for your future self. Okay.
But I'm just saying, so as a white kid, most of the other white engineers that I dealt with on the mine just saw themselves, and they never even saw apartheid finishing. I mean, that was how narrowly focused they were, where I could see that the end was the beginning of the end. And within a few years, as it so happened in 1990 with Mandela's release, you know, things started rapidly changing in South Africa. But I saw my role bigger than me. And so it was interesting, the black workforce, the people of color who worked for me, and there were 5,000 of them at one point, used to call me Makosi. And in the vernacular language, Makosi is translated as little boss. And I'm 5'6", so maybe that made sense. But I asked one of the guys one day, I said, what does Makosi really mean? And he said, it's actually a term of respect for a leader who deserves respect, not because they're a good person, not because they're a leader, not because they're there by job. He said, they didn't call any of the other engineers Makosi. They called me Makosi. And to me, that made, as a young 21 or 22-year-old engineer, the impact that I had obviously had on the people around me made me understand. And again, this was an analysis years later, when I sat down and looked at what did I actually do on the mines? Did I impact people's lives? I must have. When the workforce called me Makosi, little boss or little leader, it's a sign of respect as opposed to just a term of it was a term of endearment. And so that obviously showed through in the way I was trying to understand how what I could do could make everyone's lives better around me. But as a 21-year-old, did I appreciate what I was doing? Probably not. Probably in my 30s, I started appreciating what I'd actually done.
Okay. What did you think your life would look like in the future?
I knew it wasn't going to be underground. I knew I wasn't going to be an engineer. Okay. I knew that I wanted to influence the direction of a business and the way things went. Okay. And so that was why I left the mines. I went off to do my MBA, because at the time I saw the MBA and I saw business school as the ticket to entrepreneurship. I was pretty wrong. MBA is not a ticket to entrepreneurship. The entrepreneur comes from within the heart. But I always knew, I mean, I started my first business when I was 14. I always knew that I was never going to fit into the corporate mold. I'm so glad I spent 2 years in the corporate world in South Africa, because it really taught me what I didn't want to do. It taught me a lot of things about how I manage staff today differently from the way I was managed. Did it form my life? No, but it told me I wanted to be an entrepreneur. It told me that I needed to be my own boss, that I'm too much of a free spirit. I need to be able to make a decision and live with it for right or wrong. And I think that's the biggest holdup that people have, is they're too scared to make a decision in the first place.
Now, do you think that if you were born black in apartheid South Africa, you would have these same aspirations?
Probably not. Born in the 1960s in South Africa, for young black people, I mean, I have a number of friends today who I met, you know, at the time and have met subsequently, you know. But I think the people born of color in the 70s and maybe the 80s have experienced an incredibly different life to those who were born in the 60s in South Africa.
You know, it's funny, because I think in my sort of own, you know, understanding and research into economies, you find that in these places, there existed these kind of underground pirate economies that were in essence very much, if not innovating what entrepreneurship looked like, it was definitely making a way into creating their own business structures without having traditional education to inform their decision-making, right? So I think it's such an interesting thing to think about a version of you that would have existed then as a black person or a person of color, because the question then becomes, would you have been driven by your own passion, want to innovate, want to create economy, want to be self-sufficient, or not? Because in the absence of opportunity, how do we then show up as our best selves, as our most excellent selves, as our greater selves, right? How do we do that when opportunities aren't in our favor versus when opportunities are? So I think that's an interesting point of thought.
It's an amazing one. I've never thought of it like that. And it's interesting. So one of my great friends, a guy by the name of Tolly Nguyen, who did his MBA with me. Yep. And again, I did my MBA in 1988, which was, again, 2 years before the release of Mandela. Although at the time, it was, you know, very much spoken about that the release of Mandela and the dropping of the apartheid laws and the unbanning of the African National Congress were all going to happen within a short timeline. Yeah. So it was pretty much accepted already that that was going to happen. So Tolly Nguyen was a at the time a young black entrepreneur. There were three men of color who did the MBA with us, and there were about 40 of us on the MBA program. And Tolly and I sat next to each other for an entire year of lectures. And his standing line was, times are tough in the informal sector. Because, again, he was very much into business and had started a couple informal businesses, but under the radar, because technically at that point, he wasn't allowed to be in business, wasn't allowed to be a business owner. In fact, he lived in the middle of Johannesburg City, which was still illegal for him to live in Johannesburg City.
Yeah.
Because of restrictions of where people of color could live. So, you know, when I look at his life, would I have turned out like him? I mean, he also had spent time in the US, had studied in New York. He'd got a scholarship to university in New York. So his undergraduate degree was actually an American degree. And I look at his life and say, you know, would mine have been similar? Maybe. You know, our motivations, our system of values was very, very similar, which is why we literally sat next to each other for an entire year, studied together, and really became close friends because we did share a lot of similar values.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to see now is you look at South Africa 25, 30 years on, the emerging megapreneurs, guys who've really made it big in South Africa, now a lot of them were probably 10 years younger than us. So they were born into a much more open society or you know, became teenagers in a much more open society where entrepreneurship was encouraged. I mean, there was very much this underlying in the predominantly black, you know, areas, there was definitely an underlying level of trade and an underlying economy that was outside the South Africa, and it still exists today. There is still a very big secondary economy there.
Yeah, I mean, listen, In the States, I think we're facing this very much as it relates to cannabis, marijuana, right? There's this underlying economy that exists with people who sell it, people who go to jail for it, whatever. And then now there has developed a state-regulated version of this that has spurred entrepreneurs, but not necessarily the ones who had suffered the most for advancing the industry, right? And so, you know, in the vacuum of opportunity, some folks will arise, some folks will not. And a bit of it is determined by your drive, I believe, your tenacity. A lot of it is driven by resource and opportunities and your ability to get a grant or secure a loan and all that stuff. So when I think the institutions of a state or a country is open and equitable, I think that that's when you truly have an entrepreneurial state or an entrepreneurial country or entrepreneurial continent, depending on where you live at, because then all parties who have interest and knowledge in participating in that industry as an entrepreneur gets the opportunity to, and you see who actually has the right mix of network, resource, customer understanding to really rise to the top and become an effective leader of industry. To the point, there are certain places, and I guess I'll ask you this just as a tangent. There are certain places where like Uber doesn't really exist, or where something like Amazon doesn't really exist, because the front runners in those countries had already established their foothold and their share. And so I don't know about you, but like there are companies that exist in the US where I'm just like, this company is global, it has to be global. And then I go into another country and realize that there is something very similar, but very different, and typically specific and indigenous to that country that exists in the same space and that runs that space quite effectively.
Well, in South Africa, so I'll use that as a good example.
Yep.
My last visit there, I was consulting to a company there, and I went over. I have very little family. I have a few first cousins there, but my direct family are all not living in South Africa. And I was over there, and I don't know why, but I was wondering how I was going to get around. And I asked, and at the hotel, they said, oh, just use Uber. And so that, interestingly, how that had taken off.
Yeah.
But growing up there, the taxi industry, now what we call the taxi in South Africa is not the taxi like the yellow cab in New York.
Yep.
It's, yes, those existed in South Africa in some form or fashion, but the majority of the population had no public transport. So minivans, so 14-seater or 12-seater vans, became the mode of transport and almost a regulated, unregulated industry. Where, you know, thousands, in fact, millions of people were commuting daily in minivan taxis.
We have those here. They're called dollar vans in New York and other places where there's these like little mini buses or vans that come up. They typically follow the routes that a traditional bus would take or would take if the bus existed in that area. And it drops people off and picks them up. And everyone that's in that area knows the specific route and the specific time, even though that thing doesn't have a formal system around it in the same way that a public transportation would.
Well, it actually was even more complicated in South Africa. There was a series of hand signals that were used because it was still an illegal activity. And so you would see a van coming and you would use a hand signal, and I never understood them because I was this white kid.
Yeah.
But a series of hand signals that would tell the driver where you were going. And he would say, no, there's not going on that route, or, you know, he'd open the door and you'd get in and go on that routing and that routing. So there was this whole series of hand signals that were used by commuters to pick up the right taxi on the right minivan coming past.
Yeah, we kind of got the same thing. Like you gotta know what to do when it comes, otherwise it's gonna pass you by. I think for the same reason that there's this fear that, you know, you might be a person who is interested in taking them down. Listen, I wanna talk about Dive In for a bit, right? So you're also an author. And to talk a bit about the book, right? So the book was first published in 2018. And yeah. The book is about lessons learned since business school. So you talked a bit earlier about sort of, I guess I'm going to paraphrase it by being a bit of a know-it-all maybe when you were in your younger years. How does this book deal with that version of you? And talk to me just in general about what the book covers.
So yeah, how to do it easily. What happened is I sat down. So in 2015 or so, when I started writing the book, I wrote it, and then I got imposter syndrome. We started the conversation about imposter syndrome, and I wrote this book. It was about 40,000 words, and I went, no one wants to read it, so I put it away.
Okay.
And then met my eventual publisher, who's married to my cousin, and I said, look, you're the first person who's going to read it. And she said, it's great, just write another 5,000 words and we can publish it. So that was, you know, the process that I went through. What I learned was that I went into the MBA thinking it was going to teach me everything about being an entrepreneur. And what I learned coming out of the MBA is that it taught me lots of things about lots of things, but nothing in detail. But it gave me an understanding as an engineer coming out. I had an engineering background. Suddenly I learned about human resources. Suddenly I learned about negotiation. And so really the book was, how did I apply all those little bits of knowledge over the next 30 years, two continents, two listed companies, you know, lots of success in different areas. But how did I apply those lessons that I learned at business school, but I learned them since business school, because business school was very practical, was very theoretical, and I had to apply the practical level.
So what does dive in as a title indicate, right? Like, so it's lessons learned since business school. So is it that, you know, you could spend a whole entire life trying to learn this, but your best bet is just to get into it and learn as you go? Like, how does dive in play into what the book is conveying?
Okay, so the title says, you know, sometimes you just need to dive in. It's what it says on the back of the book.
Yep.
Business does not have to be complicated. Business can be simple. Take a breath, dive in, and adjust the course while you're moving. That's the blurb on the back of the book. It's been my philosophy in everything in business. But it really, the story behind the one of the early stories in the book is about my very first triathlon. I've done all my training for a triathlon, swimming in a swimming pool. Nice black line down the bottom, neat, orderly swimming. The first triathlon I did was a sea-based triathlon. And I'm standing on the beach and I'm watching the group go off before me. And I realized that there was no line on the bottom of the sea. Yep. There was no order to any of this. And it was absolute chaos. Like, people were kicking each other in the heads, whatever. But at the end of the day, you just had to dive in and adjust your course while you were moving to get the best solution. And then I realized, I had this epiphany standing on the beach, that that's how I did everything in business. Sometimes, you know, when entrepreneurs come to me today and say they're on spreadsheet 27 and they're not sure that this was a viable business, I say to them, you've done 26 spreadsheets too many. Okay, that end of the day, there's a gut feeling. The true entrepreneur has this gut feeling, and you can never replace that. That says, man, I'm just going to dive in and try this. And what's the worst thing that can happen is I'll fail.
Yeah, I mean, it is the worst thing that can happen. And I guess depending on how much money you have on the line, right, will depend on what that failure costs you. But in a way, I think it also, I think what you speak to is what I also find in talking to a lot of entrepreneurs, is that folks spend so much time on the business plan that they spend very little time understanding if the business is even needed, what people are going to think about the product, right? You spend all your time on a business name, on a logo, on a business plan, and you just don't even know if it's viable. And so you've done all of these months of research only to then find out that the thing that you thought everyone wanted isn't the thing that they want. Instead, they want this other thing that you're doing that they find really interesting and really valuable, right? And so you spend all of this time obsessing over the possibilities of things, the probabilities of things, as opposed to just going in the market and figuring out, is this thing viable? Is this?
Well, that's what I said. Adjust the course while you're moving. Yeah. You have to dive in and adjust your course while you're moving. And that's the problem, is that people get paralyzed with fear to adjust their course. They think that, you know, I get so many friends who put something on Facebook and I'm redesigning my logo. Which shade of green is important? You know, which shade of green should I use? And when I go back to them with a dismissive comment that says it doesn't matter, they get really all upset with me. And they don't understand what I'm saying. I'm saying the shade of green in your logo actually makes no difference to your business. We obsess about, oh, the logo is so amazing and it's got to represent this and this and this. Nobody cares. If you're Coca-Cola and you change your logo, maybe someone notices.
Yeah.
But for the average business out there, I mean, the number of people who, you know, when you say, oh, yeah, I want to go to that electrician. What's his business name? Oh, I don't know. Just call him John's Electrical. You know, he has his number. And you'll see someone will text you their number and it says John the Electrician. And when you get an invoice, it's from ABC Electrical Pty Limited. No one even knew the name of the business. But this guy probably spent weeks agonizing over the logo and the right font and everything else. And so the true heart of that dive in is just to say, I've got an idea. Let's back ourselves. And yes, you're right. Is there a lot of money on the line? Is it something you have to go to major production for? Well, that's a different level of business. You know, in most service industries, to adjust the service offering, very, very easy, and something that doesn't require a lot of money or a lot of time. So it is something where you can test the market and see what happens.
Hey, listen, guys, I also want you, I 100% agree with what Rail's saying, but I also think that, especially for your first business, it's okay to baby it a little. It's like all my friends that have multiple kids, they say that the first one they obsessed about, by the second one, they were like, you can eat the popcorn off the floor. It's fine. You're not going to die. Right. And so for your first one, maybe you do spend a little bit extra time kind of doing these tactics. Right. I think you don't want to lose yourself in it. Right. But your first one always feels a little special. It always feels a little, you know, I want to get it right. Just recognize, specifically if you plan on being a serial entrepreneur, that the learning curve for this is hopefully going to change for you. And that by your second business, you're not, you understand what the top 20 things, the top 20%, right? It's the Pareto's principle, that top 20 that's going to move the needle. Just want to focus on that top 20, right? And leave the rest of the 80 to be figured out as you move along in your business.
Absolutely. I think the problem we have today is that it's good and bad, that we grow up in a world of instant gratification, that if we put a post out on social media and we don't get 1,000 likes in the first 2 minutes, we get all grumpy and upset. And I think people psychologically extend that to their own businesses. You know, I've got this most amazing product and you know, the four people that I spoke to that told me it was brilliant, and now I'm not getting any sales, and they take the same instant gratification to another level in their business. And I think that's what we have to get out of our own way sometimes.
Absolutely.
You know, in order to be... To be the best, we have to get out of our own way. Get out of our own way and go, hey, let's not be wedded to it. Let's just see, can we modify it?
And I think that there's also something to your point about diversifying the people that we reference for opinion, right? If you're just going to ask people that are going to say it's great because it's your grandmother, your cousin, your best friend, then you're gonna get the, it's great, right? Are they really making informed decisions? Are they really your end customer? You know, do they have some skin in the game? Are they gonna use this thing or engage in this thing? And if not, then them giving you the yes, right? Them giving you the approval may not actually represent the opinion that's necessary for your thing to be viable. It may not represent that opinion. And so if you're surrounded with people who you know are going to assuredly give you yeses, and that's great and that's awesome, the vanilla responses, then you're going to be in a world of trouble when you actually bring that thing to market, because the internet specifically just isn't that kind. It's not kind. People are not going to like something or do something because you tell them. They're going to like it or do it because they feel driven towards it, or at the very least, they feel FOMO. They feel like your thing, to your Coke example or Pepsi, they're going to care about it because they think the rest of the world cares about it. So they're going to care about it with the rest of the world. But if you're a small brand, nobody cares like that. They're not. It's not a big brand. It's not a huge thing. It's not something they want to associate with. They're going to give you honest opinions. So, you know, make sure that if you're going to ask people about your brand, make sure you're asking a diverse set of people, because if you're asking the same people, you're going to get the same response, and they may actually be detrimental to your business.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. So you have been multiple things in your professional lifespan. And we've discussed this idea of imposter syndrome. So let's talk about it just a bit more. How do you quiet the critic in your own head as you're transitioning from professional business type to whatever the next thing is, right? From graduate, business school graduate, let's say, to MBA, from working in a mine to starting your first business, from starting your first business to growing that first business, right? To becoming an author, to becoming a speaker, right? How do you quiet the voice in your head that says, you don't deserve to exist in that space. You're not qualified for that space. How do you quiet that voice for you?
So it's something I don't think that ever goes away. I mean, I know that. So I'll use a very recent example. The last couple of days, I was traveling and I gave 3 talks over 3 days. And I got incredible feedback, video testimonials on these 3 workshops that I ran. And I came home and I was talking to my wife and I said, you know what? I actually realized, and I know this sounds completely arrogant, but let's just put in the context of this. I said, you know what? I actually realized how good I am. And she said, but surely that's never a discussion. And I said, you know, it isn't. But it's always nice to come back from a 3-day business trip after 3 workshops and go, damn, I changed those people's lives.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's taken me a long time to be comfortable in my own skin, not necessarily just this last week, by the way, but when I started out as a professional speaker, I first started out thinking people wanted to hear the stories of what I had done and apply that to their business, but I didn't finish that last link. And so I was getting pretty ordinary feedback from people, and I started doubting my own ability. As somebody who was South African Toastmasters champion in the 80s and has spent my life on stage, I was starting to doubt my own ability on stage because I had, you know, and so that's where my imposter syndrome came in quite heavily, where I went, what am I doing here? You know, do people really care about the story? Do they? And I suddenly started, I had to realize that I was probably doing some wrong things. But I wasn't, the big thing was I was never trying to judge myself against anyone else. I think we mistake imposter syndrome for envy. In other words, oh, I want to be like Tony Robbins on stage. Well, you can't be like Tony Robbins because no one else can be Tony Robbins except Tony Robbins. Okay. You know, you want to be like Brené Brown, not Dion Brown, Brené Brown. You know, you want to be like Brené Brown, only Brené Brown can be Brené Brown, but you can be Dion Brown.
Yeah.
Okay. And so for me over the years, it was about looking at what I really had to offer. And actually a big thing that helped me get over the imposter syndrome was being able to say to myself, damn, I'm actually quite good at this. But more importantly, what am I doing it for? What's my why? And my why was to make an impact on people. And did I feel I was making an impact on people? Absolutely. That got me over my imposter syndrome.
That's awesome, man. For me, as a person of color, I don't even think that I and or my group can ultimately have imposter syndrome. Mostly because I think that a lot of spaces that you occupy quite literally weren't created for you, right? So you're existing in a world that wasn't really set up for your specific for success for whatever reason. And so I've always, and a lot of friends that I have always felt like we did not belong in that space or weren't deserving of that space because that's how this space was created. And so it's interesting because as I'm now maturing in my own coaching business, I end up having conversations with folks about imposter syndrome. And I've realized that in talking to a lot of my associates, contemporaries, colleagues, I found that a lot of us actually feel the same way, that my entire life, boarding school, you know, college, working and acquiring more and being in spaces that you always are left with this feeling of, should I be here? Have I done enough to be here? And more specifically, and something that, you know, you may talk about, which is why me versus someone else, right? Like why did am I occupying this space as opposed to all of the other people that may be equally, if not more deserving than I, right? Because it doesn't then become about your own ability, right? But as you're saying, you comparing yourself, not just to the person that's ahead of you, but also to the people that are behind you, right? To the people that you are in this opportunity instead of them. And you start to doubt, well, do I deserve this space as opposed to them, right? Equally as much as you question, you know, should I be in this space and how do I get to the next one?
Well, so one of my coaches who coached me in a number of ways, He believed that all our imposter syndrome goes back to our parents. This sounds a bit Freudian and psychologically based, but when I chatted to him about it and he started sort of delving deep into, you know, how did your parents feel about you? And you mentioned, you know, your own background and going through college and boarding school, etc. Well, you know, I grew up with very conservative parents who didn't really back me as an entrepreneur, didn't see, they wanted, you know, the person who had the salary job and the 2.5 kids and the picket fence in the suburbs. And they couldn't understand the entrepreneurial mindset. And so, you know, in talking to this coach, he was absolutely convinced that any doubts that I was feeling now about myself were kind of driven by my parents. Now, you know, that's very Freudian and everything relates back to what your parents did when you were a child. I think it has some level of validity, but I also think it's also natural to understand that we don't, that as we get older, we start seeing our own limitations. And I think that's probably the other thing that contributes to imposter syndrome, is we see our own limitations. And whereas young people, we don't see those. We just see them as nothing. We don't actually even notice that they're there.
I wish, I would love a world where that was true. I think, at least I grew up sort of knowing, right? You know, like, you can't go into that store. You can't touch that thing. You can't be there, right? And so I think you mature in a space where you question your rightfulness to exist and exist in spaces. But to your point, I think that is actually the beauty of life experience, right? That is the beauty of realizing that you're a little boss. What was the name that they gave you?
Makosi,
right? That's the beauty of learning that early on, right? Is understanding your purpose, understanding, and maybe not understanding your purpose in the fullness of it, but understanding your purpose as you hold space in residency. And that because you hold space in residency, that you now get to decide what you want to do with it. And you won't let another person, whether it's a parent, an institution, society, racism, whatever that thing is, you won't let that thing hold you back, that you'll fight against the tide of uncertainty and find yourself in a place of excellence. Wow. Absolutely. I feel like I just gave a quote right there, man. Wow, I'm excited.
Quoted by Deion Brown.
Yeah, listen, I'm about that, man. We talked about two Browns today. All right, so I'm going to close out this episode by asking you two questions that I ask of everyone that has been on the Man versus Brand podcast. And then I want you to drop some information for any folks that are interested in connecting with you and learning more about your service, purchasing the books, all that great stuff. The first question is, on any streaming platform, YouTube is included, what's something that you recently watched or engaged in that you thoroughly enjoyed?
Ah, that's a trick question. No, it's actually interesting. So I don't watch like a lot of like streaming video and stuff like that.
Okay.
But what I tend to do is when I travel, like I was traveling last weekend, I tend to look for a series that I can put on in the background and just work and think about things. And what I found is I was watching the series on called Billions.
I love Billions. I'm a huge fan of Billions. I love that show. The acting is great. I believe it's on HBO or Showtime, one of those services. But yeah, Billions is amazing, man.
Yeah. So, but what's interesting is there were a couple quotes, and one of them is by Taylor, who's courting some overseas in Russian investor. And she says, "Don't worry, I'll be down there in the trenches fighting with the troops." And the Russian investor, in his Russian pseudo-Russian accent, you know, turned around to her and says, "That's the wrong approach."
Yeah.
Says, "There's a sign. There's a terminology in warfare called having your sidearms." And he says, "The leaders, the captains, the." Always have their sidearms because they need to be on the top of the mountain with an overall view of the battlefield. Says, whereas the people in the trenches are looking through a very narrow focus sight and don't have that broad view. Says, so if I'm investing in your business, I don't need you in the trenches. I need you to be on the hill, looking at the overall view and being the leader and not one of the troops. The troops understand that your role is as important being on the hill." And it was a very interesting lesson in leadership out of a fictional series.
All right, cool, man. So listen, if you're listening right now and you want to engage in some material, I like Billions. I definitely followed the first and second seasons. I'm not really sure. I think it might be in the third or fourth at this point. But it's an awesome show. It has... God, I can't even think of the redhead guy who's awesome and the character actor who is also awesome. I'm bad with names in these moments. So guys, please forgive me, but these are amazing actors and you should definitely watch it. All right. Second question is on any streaming platform. But let's ask folks who knew you, right? Like what's something that you enjoy? What would they not know that you or I'll actually like what do you or like that maybe folks wouldn't think to be apparent?
I mean, it's interesting. So there's probably very little published about me and my hockey.
Okay.
That I played as a junior. I played state level. Okay. In my 20s, broke my kneecap, stopped playing for 27 years and started playing at age 50. Stopped playing again at age 50. But the significance of that is quite important. So for those 27 years in the middle, everything I did was about me. You know, I played golf, I swam, I did triathlons, I did all these things which were individual sport driven. My performance on the day was related to my performance. Suddenly, 8 years ago, going back into playing a team sport has taught me so much more about teams, about being one little cog in the team again, that I missed for those 27 years when I didn't play team sport.
So you like to watch field hockey?
Oh, I like to watch hockey. I like to watch rugby union. Okay. I sort of understand American rules. I sort of understand Australian rules, football. I watch basketball. I watch most sports just because I enjoy the team interaction in a sport.
So what position do you play in field hockey?
I play midfield or halfback, as they say.
Nice. All right. Do you guys have left, middle, and center? Because I remember field hockey from boarding school. But in my school, and I think in the area, the New England area that I was in, field hockey was only – they had female lacrosse, male lacrosse, but you could only play field hockey if you were female. So we would watch the field hockey game, but we never got an opportunity to actually play. So we would see the formations and we would kind of understand the rules, right? Like high sticking and all that stuff, but we never really got a chance to get into it like our counterparts did. But I do remember there being three people because at the start of the game, there would be the midfielder who would have to compete for the ball, right? And so did you have a left, center, and right? In which position?
Yeah, so we have, so after the traditional layout of both soccer and hockey, actually soccer, round ball, football, is five in the forward line, three in the midfield line, two in the back line. That's the 5-3-2 is a traditional layout.
Okay.
A lot of that's changed over the years, but that's kind of where we work. So when I played at state level in my 20s, we actually played with four halfbacks. So you play with two fullbacks, four halfbacks, and four forwards. In our team now, we often play the same configuration, four forwards and four in the halfback line, with sort of a different configuration. But in the and then in your central, your attacking group, you generally have your two wings and your center forward form your three basic high forwards, call it.
So for folks who don't know, we're talking about forwards who also may be known as attacks, midfielders, and then typically, depending on kind of what you're playing, you have defense and goalies, right? So you have like a goalie, you have defense, you have middies, or they're typically known as middies here, and then you have either forwards or attacks that are playing at the other side trying to score.
Yeah. So your quarterback in football is effectively your center half or your center halfback in hockey or soccer.
Yeah.
They are the key. They're the point guard in basketball. It's all that same pivot position that pivots the entire team around that position. It's the central most attacking and defensive player on the field, and they really control the flow of play. Very much like the quarterback, very much like the point guard in basketball.
Yeah, man. I played center midi. I was crap at defense, and I was solid as attack, but not as solid as some of the other folks were. You know what it is? Because the what's interesting is when you're in the midfield, it's also an endurance game. It's a strategy game and an endurance game because you're running back and forth supporting everyone. Right. When you're in the attack or the forward, you're typically in the front. So it's really about being quick. Right. Like being able to score at like the flip of a hat. Right. And so I was always taking more time than I was supposed to set up the play. I was just supposed to hit it in when I was a forward. So I ended up being I ended up being center midi because I couldn't. And as a defenseman, I kept trying to run to the other side to score. And they were like, no. You stay back there and play your position. So probably as an entrepreneur like you, right? I thought it was about me when I was, 17, 18, and I just wanted to score because the scoring looked good, but then had to realize that so much about life is also about setting up the play, right? Or to your point, having sidearms and sitting on a hill and being able to strategize what's happening as opposed to just being focused on getting the win.
Absolutely.
All right, man. Listen, I appreciate your time. Why don't you tell any of the listeners, any of the audience that hears your voice right now, where they can find out more information about you and where they can purchase your book?
Okay, so they can come to, well, they can find me at railbricker.com or connect with me on LinkedIn as Railbricker, Instagram or Facebook. But as a good, we've had a fantastic chat. As an open offer to your listeners, if they go to railbricker.com/freebook, they can actually download the PDF version of the book. I'd love them to go to Amazon and buy it. And, you know, all other online retailers have the book, Dive In, Lessons Learned Since Business School by Railbricker. But for those who would like a PDF version, they're more than welcome to download a free copy at railbricker.com/freebook.
That is awesome. Thank you, man. Listen, for you guys that are trying to strategize book clubs in the future, then maybe you get the PDF, read it to understand what lessons you want to teach from it. And then you ask the folks in your book club to purchase the book so that there is a balance there, right? So if you're interested in the book, specifically book club heads, right? Then make sure that you get this free copy. Also, you know, anyone in your network, if you find the book to have value for you, make sure that you're leading them to that Amazon site so that Rail can get some good reviews, some purchases, all that great stuff that helps to push the book into Amazon's top seller space. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much, Rail, for being here, for talking to us, for letting us know your story, from giving us all of those awesome lessons around business, but more specifically around life and approach to life. We love those conversations over here on the podcast. We appreciate your time. Audience, I appreciate your time for listening in and joining us for these talks. Man, it gives me no more pleasure than to see you guys come back and say, man, that thing was moving. That thing spoke to me. I want to work with your guests in the future. That's that thing that really motivates me and the guests to really participate in these conversations, because not only are we sharing stories and talking you through some of your own thought processes and reaffirming things and challenging things for you, but we also get the reward of being able to engage with you guys off of the podcast and in spaces where we can further the conversation. So I want to thank you guys as the audience. This is Dion Brown. That's Rail Bricker. We are on Man Versus Brand. I appreciate you guys for listening and tuning in. Love you. And get you on the next one. Bye.
If this talk just resonated with you or could help someone you know, follow Dion or his guest on all social media platforms. Till next time. And remember, with any business or brand, give it your heart, make it real, or else forget about it. See you all soon.